This is reality proves possibility. We can do better than this. Welcome, everyone. This is Reality Proves Possibility, and we can do better than this. And I'm honored to be here with Raj Sisodia, that many of you know as the co-founder of the Conscious Capitalism Movement and currently a professor at Tech de Monterrey. And thank you so much, Raj, for being here with us. And the first question that I always ask is what comes to your mind when you hear reality proves possibility? We can do better than this.
Yeah, well, good to be with you, Michael. Thank you for having me. You know, it's an intriguing title, Reality Proves Possibility. You know, I think I can think of that in multiple ways. Just in terms of conscious business, for example, you know, a lot of people think that it's not possible, that these are idealistic principles that don't, you know, are not valid in practice, that you cannot compete and sort of succeed in this way, that you cannot simultaneously serve the well-being of all of your stakeholders, that there are inherent trade-offs in that, etc. And what we often say is that, well, if something exists, it must be possible. Right.
Exactly.
And so there are examples of companies that are in fact doing this. You know, you have to have intentionality and you have to have perseverance and belief. But extraordinary things are possible. So just the mere existence of many of these companies proves the possible, you know, it shows that this is not only possible, but real. And at the same time, it also shows us that once you attain this way of being, or once you become this, there's no guarantee that you will remain that way.
Mm.
You know, as I say, it's one thing to awaken, another thing to stay awake. And I do find that there's a danger of slipping back into the different kind of reality. So companies like Southwest Airlines, you know, or if you look at what's happening at Unilever or some other companies, what to some degree what Whole Foods went through, mm-hmm. you know, there's a danger out there. There's always a reversal, potential reverting to the mean, or becoming a sort of typical business. The gravity kind of pulls you towards that, you know. So we can explore that if you're interested.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
That is one of the challenges, you know, of consciousness.
Right. Staying awake, staying conscious. And yes, you've started in many ways some of your work, especially the conscious capitalism work, with proving, quote unquote, that many of the companies of endearment, I think you call them, are actually outperforming even the good to great companies. And that is sort of proof that reality of better business or better organizing is possible. And I think that's really sort of a driving force, but maybe you can give us a little bit of a context and background. How did you get there? And what are some of the big transformational moment that you would sort of, that you share typically when you share your story?
Yeah. So for me, you know, I was a frustrated and unfulfilled business professor teaching marketing. My mm-hmm. PhD was in marketing and business policy from Columbia. And when I started teaching in 1985, you know, this was the decade of the 80s, right? I came to New York in 81. This was the beginning of the decade of greed, as it was later called, celebrating greed as a virtue in some way. You know, the movie Wall Street,
mm-hmm.
where he talked about greed makes the world go round. This was the beginning of the tenure of Jack Welch as CEO of General Electric. And he would later on be lionized as the CEO of the century and, you know, celebrated for his approach to leadership. And then, of course, beginning of the Reagan years, etc. You know, so it was a time of sort of economic resurgence in some way, but really fundamentally focused on money and profits. and Milton Friedman's statement about that being the only purpose of business, the only social responsibility of business is to make money. Right? So that was the sort of air I was breathing when I came to this country. And I found it a little overwhelming. I came from a country, you know, India, which was not yet fully open to the world. That would come 10 years later, that in the Indian economy started opening up. There was very little marketing in India. You know, there was no commercial television, for example. You only had state-run television. They had 15 minutes of ads a day. That's it. The single channel that you got, you know, etc. So it was a very different climate. And then you come to this place, which is like a tsunami of marketing. You know, the New York Times would be 4 inches thick on Sunday with ads. And there was like everywhere you went, there was advertising. Coupons, you know, junk mail in your mailbox. I mean, it's just like a marketing mania in a way. And so my interest quickly became focused on looking at this question of how much are we spending and what are we getting for it in marketing. And I did a study, I think in 2004, that we were spending $1 trillion a year on ads and coupons and junk mail. So this does not include personal selling. That's another $1 trillion. Selling is a whole different profession. But just the marketing side of it was $1 trillion. Now, to put that into context, the GDP of India was 700 billion at that time. Right? So we were spending more on ads, coupons, and junk mail for 300 million people than a billion people were living on. Right? So on a per capita basis, it came to almost $4,000. It was $14,000 per family. More than the income of 85% of the world's population. And we're spending that on ads, coupons, and junk mail. And so my question was, wow, that's a lot of money. What are we getting for it? Is it good for customers? Is it good for companies? Is it good for society? And all my research indicated that actually there's negative consequences for customers. First of all, most customers do not trust marketing, right? The expression, that's not true, that's just marketing, you know, is commonplace in many cultures, especially in the US, but even in India, etc. Marketing is synonymous with lying and misleading people and manipulating people. And, you know, as a person with a PhD in marketing, that didn't make me feel very proud. You know, my inner dialogue was that my father got a PhD in agriculture science because he wanted to cure world hunger. And I got a PhD in marketing and I'm just out there selling more junk. To people who don't need it. My father used to say, my son is a professor of marketing, you know, with the inverted quotes. I mean, it was like, he was kind of amused by it. So, but I was to some degree ashamed, you know. And so I said, yeah, but customers don't trust marketing and, you know, they're not better off. Their lives are not, the quality of life is not better for them, you know, because there's overconsumption and there's a false set of values and, you know, all of that. We're using women's bodies to sell products. That creates eating disorders in young women, and body dysmorphia and depression. We're getting kids addicted to all kinds of junk. So, you know, there's a lot of negative things. So customers aren't being helped. Society is being hurt, right? So public health problems of various kinds, right? Obesity, diabetes, even cancers and autoimmune and then social anxiety and depression. All of these things are a consequence of kind of this commercial system that we've created. And companies were getting low returns because 98% of ads are never noticed and 99% of coupons are never redeemed. And so you're producing all of this stuff to what end? And so my question was, is there a better way? And there must be a better way. I mean, and that's an important question, I think, you know, because the answer is always yes. It doesn't matter what you're asking about. There is always a better way. There's no limit to better. And human beings, you know, we have infinite creativity. And so asking that question was important. And the way I framed it was that most companies spend a ton of money on marketing and yet they have lousy customer loyalty and trust. In fact, over time at the aggregate level, spending was going up and average customer loyalty and trust were declining. Right? Because all the sales, etc., like, you know, why would you be loyal to one brand? You would just buy whatever was on sale, right? So it was actually damaging the brands the more we were spending on all of these things. So that's the normal thing. You spend a lot of money and you get terrible outcomes. So what's the opposite of that? I said, which are the companies that spend very little money on marketing and yet they have very high levels of customer loyalty and trust? That's kind of the holy grail, right? You want loyal customers, you know, wedded to the company. And so with that lens, I started to look for companies, and I found a few in the beginning. Whole Foods was one of them, which was spending 95% below the industry average marketing. They did not have a chief marketing officer. They did not have an ad agency. And what they did spend was spent at the store level on community activities, you know, that they thought about that as marketing. But what they did do was they took care of their well-being of their customers. They were focused on that, right? So I found a few companies where customers were loyal and trusting to them, and there was barely any marketing budget to speak of. But then as I looked at those companies more deeply, initially I was just saying, okay, how do they manage the marketing function so efficiently and effectively? But I found that it was almost an afterthought. They didn't even really have a marketing function, right? But they took care of the well-being of their customers. They were focused on the well-being. They were treating their customers like stakeholders, not just as customers, you know. And then as I looked at it more deeply, I found that the employees were equally loyal and trusting to these companies, and that the two go together. Customer well-being and employee well-being are very connected. And that suppliers were in long-term, stable relationships with these companies. And that communities welcomed and embraced them, right? So they were really embedded in a system of stakeholders, that they genuinely cared about the well-being of all of their stakeholders, not just using them as a means to an end, right? But treating them as an end in themselves. And so and then I started to see, to ask the question, what makes that happen? And you found then a certain pattern in these companies, as I saw more companies like that. So there was a higher purpose, a reason for being. Right? What do you stand for? So Whole Foods is about educating people that what you put into your body makes a difference to your health, to the health of the food system, and to the health of the planet, ultimately. And customers who believe in that, you know, are naturally drawn to Whole Foods. Employees who are passionate about food and about health are drawn to Whole Foods. Investors who care about that are attracted to Whole Foods, etc. So it really creates kind of a magnet. It brings together the right customers, the right employees, the right investors, the right suppliers. And then you have these core values that you hold dear that define your culture, and that also resonates outside with customers as well, you know, and other stakeholders. So I started to find these pillars, you know, what we now call conscious capitalism, higher purpose, or stakeholder orientation. Conscious leaders who care about the purpose and the people, they're not primarily motivated by power and ego and money. Right? They care about the business. So every executive at Whole Foods is passionate about food and health. Everyone at a company like Patagonia is passionate about the outdoors and nature, right? So it's not just a mercenary approach to leadership that doesn't matter. I'm running an airline today and a hotel tomorrow and a food company the day. No, I can run every business through the lens of numbers. Every business might look similar, but there's a soul. There's a soul to a business, you know, if you really honor it well, that it's trying to be something in this world, you know. So conscious leaders and then a caring culture, where we found that, you know, most companies' cultures are really toxic and purely performance-based. And there's a high level of stress, and heart attacks are 20% higher on Mondays, and a lot of statistics around lack of employee engagement and high levels of burnout, and 120,000 Americans dying from stress every year, and 600,000 Chinese dying from overwork. And, you know, we have very, very toxic work environments for the most part. But in these companies, people love their jobs, and they don't say, thank God it's Friday, and oh God, it's Monday, you know, for them. Work is a source of meaning and joy. And so we discovered those four pillars of conscious capitalism in that process. But I didn't have that language. Right? I was just looking at, the book was called Firms of Endearment, you know, inspired by that movie Terms of Endearment, right? So companies that are loved. This was a radical idea in 2005, you know, the idea of even using the word love in the context of business. But for me, it was a turning point, because when I discovered a set of companies that could operate with this philosophy consciously, not trying to maximize profit, but they're trying to serve their purpose and serve their people, all the stakeholders. And I was literally moved to tears as I'm writing some of the stories. of these companies. And you know, that was a signal moment for me, because for the first time after 20 years of teaching, I felt that my heart was actually connected to what I was working on, you know, my work. And I'm sure you had that experience as you got into humanistic leadership, right? Until then, it was all the head and the wallet, right? I mean, our business education, my MBA, my PhD, is all about the head and the wallet, completely bypassing the heart and the spirit. So I was never inspired a single day in my business education, and I was never emotionally moved or touched or connected to that work, right? And now both of those, I was inspired and I was touched. And I said, wow, this is a whole different feeling for me. I, for the first time, I felt actually fully alive in my work, you know, and having tears of joy, you know, connected to your work is a very precious thing. You know, most people might experience anger or frustration or disappointment and other emotions, but experiencing tears of joy because of your work is a very precious thing. So in that moment, I felt that my purpose kind of landed on me. You know, I, without knowing it, I was searching for meaning and purpose. And I was at the right age. I was right around 40, you know. That's kind of midlife crisis time, right? So this was a little after I turned 40, actually. 40 is when I had my midlife. Then I was searching. I was in that inquiry after I had my kind of midlife crisis, you know, period. And then when we found later on that the when we did the financial analysis at the end, see, the difference between our book and many other books is we didn't start out with handpicking a set of high-performing companies and then saying what makes. We found this pattern. We discovered this pattern, right? We had gone looking for something quite small, but we found something much larger, a whole different way of being. And then we did the financial analysis, now fully expecting that these companies, first of all, are not trying to maximize profit, number one. Secondly, they are paying their people much better, like, you know, Costco was paying double of Walmart, you know, to their employees, providing much better benefits to frontline employees, like healthcare. They're paying their suppliers well. They're not squeezing their suppliers like many companies do. They're investing in their customer experience. They're investing in their local communities. They're investing in the environment. And they were even paying taxes at a higher rate of 34% on average for that initial set of companies. So my hypothesis was, well, you know, maybe these companies' returns are good, but nothing spectacular because they're not trying to. That's not their goal, you know. But they're creating all this other kind of value, which we don't capture normally, right? The well-being of your employees and their children, your customers' health and well-being, and so forth. And what we actually found was that these companies had outperformed 9 to 1 over at the S&P 500 over 10 years, and they had also outperformed the good to great companies, I think by 3 to 1 over that same period. And that was a shock to us because we didn't expect that, you know. That was and then we redid our analysis to make sure we hadn't, you know, messed up the math somewhere. But it was true. And then we said, okay, let's take out Whole Foods from the analysis. Maybe one company is swamping the result, and, you know, let's take out Google. And Google was in that set at that time. But it was still pretty robust, you know. And then we started to try to understand, how can you deliver such high performance even while you're doing all this other stuff? You're spending money in all these areas. Well, it turns out you're also saving a lot of money in other areas, right? Marketing costs are zero for many of these companies. Employee turnover is a fraction. Costco was 7%. Walmart was 70% at that time. Right? Walmart had to hire 2 million people to replace those who left voluntarily. Costco people join and never leave, so they become much more productive over time. Right? Legal costs are lower, administrative costs are lower. So you're saving a lot of money in those. Yeah, those are largely wasted expenses, you know. If you think about it, they don't really create value for anybody, right? Real value. And but you are spending money where it makes a difference, paying your people well so they can live a dignified life, right? They're not struggling, etc. And so, and then you're getting the other side of that, which is extraordinary levels of customer loyalty, employee engagement, when the average is 22% or whatever worldwide, and these companies are really 95% passionate commitment. That makes a huge difference. And when your customers become your ambassadors and your marketers, right, that makes a huge difference. And, you know, you get lots of reputation is positive. You get a lot of positive media, etc. So we started to explain that. So anyway, that's a long answer to your question that this became my awakening to my own purpose, connecting to my own innate idealism as a human being. I had that, but I had to suppress all of that because I was in a dog-eat-dog world of business, and it's only, only the paranoid survive, and it's only about profit. And that scene from The Godfather where he gets somebody killed, and later on he's telling the son, "Don't take it personally, it's only business, right? That I killed your father." That kind of mindset, that I thought I was in that world, and that there was no place for my idealism and my, innate desire for harmony and for everybody to, do well. But I found it's possible in business. So anyway, that led to me to meet John Mackey, the CEO of Whole Foods, who loved that book, Forms of Endearment, invited me to spend a day with him. And at the end of that day, I shared my vision for what I was calling at the time the Institute for New Capitalism, or INC. I have a fetish for acronyms for everything. So, but he looked at my mind map and he said, "That's exactly my vision, but I like the phrase conscious capitalism," which it turns out was coined by Muhammad Yunus, the Grameen Bank micro lending pioneer. But he was using it to refer to what we now call a social business, which only has a social purpose. And all the profits get reinvested back in that purpose. So we're using it more broadly to say, yes, every business should have a social purpose and society is a main stakeholder, but we also need financial wealth generation. And that's important for society to function well. And so yeah, that's how we started the movement. Then we said, okay, let's try to create something out of this. So 2008 is when we launched our movement.
I think I was actually there for one of the early, very early conferences.
Yes, so you were at the Bentley conference. So we
Bentley,
started
the
then
Bentley,
doing, we did the CEO conferences in Austin, and then we started the academic, more sort of open, but also academic conferences in Boston when I was at Bentley University. And yeah, I remember meeting you there,
No, that's fantastic.
2009, 10, that time frame.
Great. So yeah, that sort of gives a little bit of the origin story of your own awakening. I think since you then you have written a number of really powerful books, New York Times bestsellers, et cetera, that also showcase the story of other businesses that prove that reality is possibility. But also you go a little bit more into your personal story and your own like shift, et cetera. Do you want to just share a little bit what is sort of like what has emerged since? What are some of the key things or takeaways or insights that for you, and also where are you focusing now? What is sort of the main lever of change or transformation or commitment that you develop for yourself?
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
I'm April Hardy, crime victim advocate trained by NOVA, founder of In Case I'm Murdered, and recent recipient of a $12,500 grant for intimate partner homicide prevention work. I've experienced domestic violence from both sides, as the employee whose performance suffered, and as the business owner who absorbed every cost directly. This is the Safe Work Advantage podcast that helps HR professionals and business leaders recognize risk, reduce liability, and protect their people.
Yeah, so my journey continued after we launched Conscious Capitalism, the movement. We then wrote the book in 2013. We're doing a second edition of that book now, actually, we're working on. But that book came out in 2013 with John Mackey, the Conscious Capitalism book. And then I continued exploring different dimensions of this. So for example, I had observed that in these conscious businesses that I had come to know, there was a lot more caring and compassion and empathy and inclusion and these values which are considered to be feminine qualities. And even though the CEOs mostly were men, but there was much more feminine energy and in these companies, and even in those leaders, they were more integrated beings. So that idea of the rise of the feminine as an essential and necessary and needed element to heal our world and to heal business was a theme that I wanted to explore. And so I wrote a book called Shakti Leadership with my co-author Nilima, Shakti being the Indian word for the divine feminine, which is seen as the source of life and source of, you know, beauty and joy and dynamism, you know, in the Indic system. And so the premise of that book is that we have lived in a world that has been dominated by masculine energy and by men, which are not synonymous. You know, all of us have both, right? Every human, we all come from a mother and a father. We have both of those qualities. As Carl Jung said, every man has an inner woman, every woman has an inner man, right? We have that, the yin and yang, all of that. But in society, for various reasons, because physical strength was at a premium, you know, for much of our history and so forth, so men came to dominate. But that then extended into all sectors, political, business, you know. Women could not own property, even in this country, in the U.S. Women could not vote until 1920, and women could not get a credit card in their own name until the 1970s. You know, they had to have a father or a husband or a brother co-sign with them. So there's been a historically this massive level of suppression of the feminine, of women and of the feminine, right? And that's why the history of humanity is one of constant strife and wars and incredible levels of cruelty and so forth. Because in the absence of the feminine, that's what happens to the masculine, right? Everything becomes hyper-aggression, domination, winning at all costs, etc. You know, and that translated into business as well. So anyway, that was one dimension that I explored in that book. And then other books as well, Everybody Matters, which was about really answering, in a way, one of the premises of your question, which is some people would look at a Whole Foods and a Patagonia and say, okay, conscious capitalism is fine for these fancy businesses, you know, the upscale kind of niche kind of companies. But it really doesn't work in the real world of, you know, nitty-gritty manufacturing and so forth. And so Everybody Matters, as you know, is the story of Bob Chapman and Barry Waymiller, which is a company that is relatively low-tech manufacturing, producing machines that make toilet paper or cardboard boxes or packaging and of various kinds, and showing the transformation that happened there when they started adopting some of these more people-centric approaches, putting people at the center, right? Treating everybody as somebody's precious child, as Bob says, measuring success by the way we touch the lives of people, etc. And having a dramatic transformation result from that. So same people, same business that was struggling and almost bankrupt started to thrive. And then they started acquiring other such businesses, of which there are many. There are many struggling small manufacturing businesses out there, you know, that think they cannot compete anymore in this world with lower labor costs elsewhere in the world. So Bob has acquired 140 companies by now and turned them all around, you know, applying this fairly straightforward and simple idea of putting people at the center of everything that you do. And so I think that book kind of democratizes this message to say this applies to everything. You know, it applies in Estonia and applies in Wisconsin and in India, and you can apply it to basic manufacturing, blue collar workforce. You know, people are human beings, aspire to many of the same things all over the world, you know. But then as I got further into it, you know, the idea that business creates a lot of suffering in the world, unnecessary suffering. The way we do it in the pursuit of profit, we end up, you know, people become treated as objects and resources and assets, and, you know, we dehumanize. And as a result, there's a lot of suffering. I talked about heart attacks and, you know, all the other things. And something in me really rebelled at that notion that business, you have to hurt people to make money. You know, I said, I don't want to be part of a system that creates suffering, you know, in order to make money. And so I explored that idea that can business actually do the opposite? And I knew it can. I mean, I already had examples of companies that were doing it, right? The idea of business as healing.
Right.
And thinking of business, what is business? Business is a way that we meet each other's needs, right? We serve each other. In a free market society, governments don't take care of us, but they create the conditions where businesses can sense and then meet our needs for everything, right? All the different dimensions of our lives. When you do that in a loving way, right? But I'm here to, we're here to take care of each other in a way, serve each other, take care of each other. That becomes a healing act, right? So if you start to think of business as a way to express yourself, why am I here? What am I meant to do in this lifetime? Express yourself and serve others, right? That becomes healing. But if you use business as a way to use others to serve yourself, then that becomes a source of suffering. You could be in the same exact business, right? But your mindset, this is for me to make money, and I need to use employees, and I need to do what it takes to get customers, to buy my product, etc. That becomes, so the idea that business, it's not about business, healing businesses, it's not about saying we need more yoga studios and massage places or retreat centers. It's about business itself as a healing act. Because it's about meeting people's real needs, not feeding their wants, desires, and addictions, which is what a lot of business has become. Understand your real need and meet it in a loving way. That's healing you. Okay? And that's going to heal me as well as the one doing the business. So that idea of healing, I explored at great depth in the book, The Healing Organization. We have 20 stories of companies that are actually doing that, right? They're a place of healing for their employees. You at the end of the day, you're not burned out and depressed and whatever. You're actually stronger physically, mentally, emotionally, spiritually, and socially than when you came in that morning. Right? So it's a place of healing for those who work there. It's a source of healing for those they serve, their customers, their communities, and a force for healing in society. So that idea, I think that consciousness, this is kind of the next level of consciousness, which is actively seeking ways in which we can bring joy in the world and create, you know, reduce suffering. There's a lot of suffering in our world. You know, we've made a lot of progress in material terms, but there's extraordinary levels of suffering still. You know, 3 billion people still living on less than $5 a day, and 1 billion people not having access to clean water, and I don't know, 15,000 kids dying of preventable causes every day, and epidemics of depression and drug addiction, and oh, so much, right? So unless we are part of the healing, we will be part of the hurting. We have to consciously choose the part of healing, individually as well as for our organizations. And then, you know, over time, I've come to realize even more keenly that it all depends on the consciousness of the leaders. Whether you have a healing organization or a hurting organization depends on the leader. Because what shows up in the organization is an amplification of what's inside the leader. Right? The macrocosm is a reflection of the microcosm. And therefore, if you want to heal out in the world, we have to start by healing within. And so my next book is called Healing Leaders, 7 Steps to Recovery of Self. These are steps that came to me at a silent retreat in a place called Peace Village in upstate New York in 2018. And that was it's an important thing for all of us to have that experience of silence once in a while, you know. Because that's really when you can connect to the source and connect within and understand yourself and, you know, just not be distracted by the bombarding of external stimuli all the time, you know. But these steps came to me as a pathway to healing for us so that we can be sources of healing in the world. And so the steps are know yourself. Who are you? What makes you unique among the 117 billion humans who have ever lived? Every single one of us is different. And so if you want to live an authentic life, you have to know what you're being authentic to. Right? Who are you? Not your identity and your degrees and your religion and your nationality and all of the markers of identity, but actually the essence of you, you know, as a human. And then love yourself, which is a challenge for many of us.
Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Hi, I'm Sarah Beth Herman, a 5-time CEO and host of the podcast No Silver Spoons. This show is for leaders, entrepreneurs, and people building something meaningful without shortcuts. We talk about leadership, mindset, business growth, and the real lessons that come from doing hard things really well. And if you're in the dental industry, you'll hear a few episodes that speak directly to that world too. Because no matter your field, leadership is leadership. Listen to No Silver Spoons wherever you get your podcasts.
I think most people, maybe 80, 90% of people do not love themselves. Mm-hmm. You know, they have a very, very challenging relationship with themselves. They have a lot of negative self-talk.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they disparage themselves, etc. For many reasons. You know, well, where does that come from? From parenting, from the culture, from media, etc. But you have to get to that place of not only accepting yourself, forgiving yourself, being compassionate towards yourself, but actually loving and celebrating the unique qualities that make you who you are. You know? Mm. That's the gift you came here with. That's what you're meant to bring into the world. Right? So the next step is to be yourself. Once you know yourself and love yourself, then be yourself. Right? Not be acting and pretending to be somebody else, putting on all these masks.
Mm-hmm.
Being the same person at home, at work, with your with your children, with your parents, with your spouse, with your colleagues, with your boss, with the people who report, you know, everybody. You know, we shouldn't have all these different personas, you know.
Mm.
And then express yourself. I'm sorry, the next one is choose yourself, which is about choosing your past, choosing your present, and choosing your future. Choosing your past is interesting. You know, we very often, many of us, we lament aspects of our upbringing, our parenting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, oh, why did I have this kind of father, this kind of mother? Why was I born into this, etc.? We become victims of our own experiences. But the invitation here is to actually say, you know, I don't understand why, but I believe that that was there for a reason, and that's shaping me into who I'm meant to be, and that's preparing me for the work I'm meant to do. So, for example, I was born into a highly misogynistic, feudal, hyper-masculine, patriarchal, warrior caste culture in India. And I witnessed a lot of abuse, you know, of women, of workers, of many others. And I used to say, why was I born into this? You know, it's so contrary to my nature. And so forth. But then at some point I had the realization that I had to experience all of that, the worst of that masculine dominant energy, so that I would write a book about the feminine. I would not have that sensitivity, right? So everything starts to make sense. And it came to me actually at one of the meals at that silent retreat, when the volunteers are in silence as well, and you're not supposed to communicate at all. So when you have a tray, you put your tray there and they just put food in it. They don't ask you what do you want and how much. And I said, that's a good metaphor for life. You know, you don't get to order. There's no buffet. I'll have this kind of mother and this kind of father, and I'll have more of this and less of this, you know. There's no menu that you can order from. You're given a tray full of stuff. And that's your curriculum for this life. Now, some of it appears unappetizing and some of it tastes bitter. But you need all of it, you know. That's your curriculum. It's your medicine. And through that, you will then become who you're meant to be and do what you're meant to do. You know? So in that sense, choosing your past, not just tolerating it or accepting it, but saying yes. You know? And then choosing your present, living in gratitude, choosing your future, you know, stepping into your hero's journey, you know, and not being afraid to, you know, to venture out beyond your safety, circle of safety, right? And then the next one is to express yourself, which is about discovering and living your purpose, choosing growth over safety. And then complete yourself, which is the fragmented parts within us, the feminine, the masculine, the elder and the child energy. Right? Many of us have suppressed or we haven't developed many of those aspects. So we are fragmented beings. Can we become whole by integrating all of them, you know? The summary phrase that we use is becoming the wise fool of tough love. The wisdom of the elder, the foolishness of the healthy child within you, the playful, that's the playfulness, the creativity. And then the toughness of the masculine, the love of the feminine. Can we have all of that manifesting within our own beings, you know, and cultivating that which we have not fully developed. And then the last one is heal yourself, which is about healing your body, but mostly about healing your psychological wounds and traumas. And we all carry psychic wounds, and we all have some degree of post-traumatic stress injury. You know, 13 million Americans, I think, are diagnosed with post-traumatic stress disorder, PTSD, but I think all of us have PTSI, because life is hard, post-traumatic stress injury. Even being born is a traumatic experience, for the mother and the child. And then there are many other things that happen in our lives. There's personal trauma, things that happen, bad things that happen that should not have happened to you, or good things that should have happened but did not happen. You didn't receive the acceptance, the unconditional love from your parent, for example. So there's a lot of personal trauma. There's family trauma, things that happened before you were born into in your family of origin. Your parents had their own trauma, right? And you're affected by that. And then there's ancestral trauma. Multi-generations ago, things that happened are still impacting us today through the expression of our genes, right? Epigenetics. So we don't even know why we are afraid of some things. Or why we have certain tendencies. And then there's a collective trauma. You know, the pandemic or climate change or you know, many, many things, political environment we're in right now. So there's a lot of trauma and most people tend to ignore it or minimize it. They say, I didn't go to Afghanistan or Iraq, so why should I complain about my little problems? Other people had much worse trauma than me. It's true. But that doesn't mean your trauma doesn't matter. You're still impacted by it. It's, you're not in charge of your own emotions and your own actions and your own words because you haven't healed those, you know, those landmines that are buried inside you. And so we have a duty, I think, all of us to, as we say, my partner Nana says, we have to reveal it and feel it in order to heal it. You know, we have to uncover that trauma. In my case, I had some trauma that was buried, that I had suppressed the memory. It's called dissociative amnesia. Things, you know, pretty severely traumatic things that happened between me and my father, which I've written about all this in a book called Awaken, my memoir, which is part of the revealing it. You have to reveal it. You know, you have to talk about it. No, nothing can heal if you don't talk about it. And more openly you can talk about it, the better. Because then it can help others. You see? Because everybody is ashamed that, oh, God, it's happened to me, and you know, but the fact is, many people can relate to that, you know. And so yeah, there's the good news is that we're living at a time when we have many, many modalities for healing trauma. You know, there are dozens of approaches that are available, from EMDR to, you know, internal family systems to even now a lot of psychedelics, MDMA assisted psychotherapy. You know, so there's a lot of ways so we can heal ourselves, you know. And then when you go through all of these steps. And it's not one and done, right? It's a it's an ongoing process. I think you move more and more towards that wholeness and healing, and then you become a loving, caring leader in the world. And you attain more inner peace for yourself. Because for me, what I realized in the process of writing my memoir is that, you know, I found my purpose back in 2005, 2006, 2007, you know, when I was writing Firms of Endearment. And then launching Conscious Capitalism enabled me to enact that purpose. But I did not have inner peace and I was unhappy. You know, so I had found spiritual meaning in my life, which is the purpose. Right? That's a spiritual dimension. But I did not have personal happiness. I did not have mental, physical, emotional well-being. And so that's all been part of my journey since, especially since 2018, and uncovering these traumas and working on my own healing. And actually, there were four women that year who basically gave me that same message. I was writing the Healing Organization that year. I turned 60 that year in 2018. And they all said to me some version of this, that you're writing a book about healing in business, but what about your own healing? And my initial answer was, well, I don't have time for that. I have a book deadline. October. This book is due October 5th. And they said, no, you need to make time for that. You know, book deadlines are flexible. It's important. You cannot write a book about healing if you don't work on your own healing. And so that started the journey for me. Right? I went to that silent retreat. I went to the Himalayas where I had my 60th birthday. Up in the, between India and Tibet, where there's a lot of Buddhist wisdom there about suffering. I went to the Amazon rainforest with the Pachamama Alliance, and that's where I had 10 days in the rainforest with the shamans, and I had many different healing modalities with them, including ayahuasca, and that gave me incredible insights about healing, which we can talk about if you want. And I also worked with a coach for the first time. You know, and she kind of framed my life journey in a way that instantly clarified. You know, she said to me, do you realize that you spent 45 years trying to impress your father? You know, he cared about status and power and money and ego. And, And now you spent the last 15 years honoring your mother with your work.
Mm-hmm.
That everything you've done with Conscious Capitalism, Forms of Endearment, all of these other books that are really bringing your mother's energy into business and leadership where it is lacking. Right? There's no mother energy in business. Very little. You know, so all of those things set me on my path towards healing. You know, and that's what I've been working on the last 5-6 years. And you know, that's a journey I think all of us need to be on for our whole lives, you know.
Yeah.
And the more we heal, the more we can have a positive impact in the world.
Absolutely, absolutely. Well, thank you for sharing that. And I've heard you say some of these things before. And at the same time, I think the interesting thing maybe is like, how were you able to give yourself permission to do all of these things, being an academic or being in all of these patterns? Like, what were some of the things you mentioned that there were four women giving you that pointer, and at some point you paid attention to it, but anything else? And maybe even the ayahuasca and that's sort of, I think, maybe losing its stigma or maybe getting more popular in certain ways. But I think still in many circles that's frowned up on. And
Yeah, I think we stigmatize the wrong things in society very often. You know? Many things that are acceptable should not be so acceptable. And many other things that are taboo are just, you know, silly and wrong, you know. I think for me, Michael, I'm not, I would say, a typical academic. Okay, and I don't think anybody should be a typical anything. Each of us should be our own version, right? We should be our own version of whatever it is that we are.
Yes.
Not try to conform. So I've always been somebody who's challenged the prevailing mindset or status quo. You know, I challenged it in my own culture. You know, I wasn't a typical warrior caste kid like my cousins and others. You know, they bought into the whole thing. But I know, and part of it is my upbringing, because I had the benefit of a childhood where I was an outsider and an insider at the same time. So I lived in India until I was 7. And then we moved to the West, to Barbados and California and Canada for 5 years. And then went back to India when I was 12. And then I came back to the US when I was 23. Right? So I kind of had this a foot in both cultures, but also simultaneously being an insider and an outsider. I could look at things in the US from outsider eyes and be a little more objective about it, I think. And then when I went back to India, I could look at that with somewhat American eyes and said, wow, what are we doing in these in many aspects of that culture? And so I think having that sort of some degree of detachment, and not drinking the Kool-Aid, as they say, and being able to observe with some degree of objectivity and not buying into the whole thing. And I became an academic by accident. You know, it wasn't that I was a child who grew up aspiring to be a marketing professor. I mean, I don't know many children that do, right? That would be a strange little child. But in my case, you know, I was finishing my MBA in Bombay. And I already had a job lined up. It was the last semester. And then one day I come down for breakfast and 7 or 8 of my friends were dressed up and going somewhere. I said, where are you guys going? So we're going to the U.S. Information Agency to get GMAT applications. I said, why do you need that? We're already getting our MBA. He said, we want to apply for a PhD in business. I said, oh, I didn't know you can get a PhD in business. So I said, give me 5 minutes. I'll change and I'll come with you. You know, and so the irony is that from that group of 8 of us, now I'm the only one who ends up coming to the U.S. to get a PhD in business. I got a full scholarship at Columbia and Michigan and so forth. So I said, wow, suddenly, I mean, literally 6 months later, I'm standing in Times Square. and life took a complete right turn. And now suddenly I was on a different career trajectory. I saw it just as a way of getting back to the U.S. I lived here as a child, and I had fond memories of my childhood here. And so, but I didn't say, wow, I really aspire to, you know. And why marketing? Because I didn't like finance. As simple as that.
Yeah.
Those were kind of the two big choices in our business school in India. And so, but given that I had come into it with that kind of outsider perspective, I wasn't fully bought into it. You know, I could look at it in a little more detached way. And so I think staying true to yourself, even while you're part of a profession, part of a religion, part of a culture, part of country, you know, nationality, holding your identity lightly, not letting it define you, you know. I am this. Mm-hmm. I happen to be doing this, you know. Mm-hmm. That's not who I am.
Right, right, right.
I'm not a marketing professor. That just happens to be my job at that time, you know. But then it gave me a certain degree of objectivity about looking at it, I think, and not being a typical anything.
Mm.
And questioning the status quo and the, you know, the rules. So I remember once I was up for, going through my tenure process at George Mason University.
Mm.
This would be 1994, I think. Yeah. And there's something that happened in the news. Disney and ABC were merging, Disney and Cap Cities. They announced a big merger, and I had done some research on synergy. Companies merge because they want some, they see some synergy, right? Some cost savings or some, and they end up paying a premium. Right, so I think Disney was paying a 60% premium over the stock price of Cap Cities, anticipating massive synergies. Right, and I looked at that and I said, well, I think there could be some negative synergies in this merger, you know, because of the vertical, it's a vertical integration. Right? So Disney would now have to put their content on ABC, and ABC would have to source their content from Disney. Even though they might get better deals. There was a logic to what I was. So anyway, I wrote an op-ed for the Wall Street Journal, calling it something like, "The celebration may be premature." You know, now they published it the next day under the headline, "A goofy deal."
Uh-huh.
Okay. A goofy deal. So, you know, they changed the. But anyway, I was feeling pretty good about it. I said, okay, this is, you know, a million, I don't know how many people, you know, subscribe to this thing. So I get a loud knock on my door as I'm sitting in my office the next morning. And it's Bob Bazell, who was like the most senior professor in our department. He had come from Harvard, you know. He's a very well-known professor. He didn't say good morning or anything. He just said, "What the hell are you doing?" I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Why are you publishing in the Wall Street Journal?" I said, "Well, something happened, a big news story, and I had done some research that, you know, had some relevance to this, and I would..." He said, "That's not your job. You should be sitting here writing, you know, journal articles. Right? You're not a journalist, right?" And then he turned around and walked away. You know, and he was voting on my tenure, by the way, at that time. You know, I was up for... I was quite shaken. And then he turned around and looked back and he said, "Oh, by the way, you didn't cite my research. You know, I've done some research in that area." Maybe there's some ego there. And then I got a call from my friend at Georgia Tech, I was a professor there. And he said, "Congratulations on the Wall Street Journal article." I said, "Well, thank you, I needed that." He said, "Yes, but you realize it's academic suicide." I said, "What do you mean?" He said, "Yeah, this is, you know, they look down on this. This will count against you," you know. And then I just got mad. I said, "That's crazy. You know, that's like, I don't want to be... I do not subscribe to that value system that says we're sitting in an ivory tower in academia and we cannot be engaged with the world of practice."
Yeah,
you know?
Right.
Like, what are we doing here? And so from that moment, I became determined to not let that, not curb my natural instincts to do certain things in a certain way. I always wanted to be applied, you know, to be practical in my research or my writing, that it should be something I can use with my MBA students, should be something relevant to managers, etc., you know. And so I stayed true to that. I wrote 6-7 more of those Wall Street Journal articles over the years. And then some academics started calling me and saying, "How do you get published in the Wall Street Journal? Can you help me?" So I think it's just, you know, as I said, staying true to that and not being a typical anything. You know, be your version of whatever. That's authentic, living an authentic life, you know. Not to be arrogant about it, say that I'm right and everybody else is wrong, but be true to yourself, you know. That's an old dictum, but it's very, very important, I think.
Wonderful, wonderful. Well, thank you so much, Raj. We end this episode typically with a question from Marcel Proust's questionnaire that just a way to reveal another side. So would you just share a number from 1 to 35 and then I'll ask you?
17.
Let me see. Which talent would you most like to have?
I wish I could play the tabla, which is an Indian instrument, percussion, right? Like the drums, you know, played with your fingers. I just love the sound of the tabla. And I've tried to learn it over the years, but I've never dedicated, you know, the number of hours it takes and the amount of dedication. But I wish I could do that. And, you know, maybe at some point I will return to that passion, you know.
Wonderful. Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Raj, for being here. I think you showed a couple of real examples of reality proving possibility, including your own life journey. And thank you so much for just spending the time with us here.
It's my pleasure, Michael. Thank you for having me.
Thank you.